Welcome to the Regen Brands Podcast. This is a place for consumers, operators, and investors to learn about the consumer brands supporting regenerative agriculture and how they're changing the world. This is your host, Kyle, joined with my co-host, Dave C. Let's dive in. On this episode, we have Sorella and Matt, who are the co-founders at Simply. Simply is supporting regenerative agriculture through their regenerative organic quinoa and other retail and food service items. In this episode, we learn about Sorella and Matt's journey starting Simply and their big vision to ethically source the highest quality, single origin ingredients while tackling fraudulent international supply chains, combating climate change, and improving the livelihoods of farmers and their communities. Tons of epic dialogue in this one, and we were thrilled to have Sorella and Matt join us fresh off of a big Nexty Award win at Expo East. Let's dive in.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Regen Brands Podcast. We are fired up today to have Matt and Sorella from Simply, fresh off of Expo East and a Nexty Award. So big time congrats to you guys, and thanks for coming on the pod.
Thank you, Anthony and Kyle. And thank you both for having us today. We're super excited to talk with both of you and to share the Simply story with you today.
Awesome. Yeah, you know, I think Anthony and I are both pretty passionate about just getting to know people in the regenerative space. This conversation is really just basically doing that on the record. So, you know, we can all get to know each other together and it's going to be fun. So for those who are not familiar with Simply, give us like a quick lay of the land, like what kind of products do you make? Where can people find you and things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, just to give a really high level, what Simply is, we are a international ingredients brand. We really focus on regenerative organic certified products. We are a fully vertical supply chain company, so which means we work direct with our farmers all over the world to bring great products to consumers across the U.S. And so we just really focus on the environmental impact, the social impact, but obviously the farming practices too that that we work with our farmers around the world with.
And the products that we focus on are grains, beans, oils, and superfoods. And it was really a natural growth into growing to these categories. We launched Simply with quinoa being a superfood grain in the Andes of Peru and Bolivia. And we just learned about rotational programs and what makes a really healthy soil and ecosystem. So beans was a natural addition to our categories. And we just continue to grow from there, really following what the land has to offer. And Simply can be found today in over 1,000 restaurants across the U.S. In food service. We work with great partners like Just Salad or Splendid Spoon or Meal Kit Companies as well. On the retail side, you can also find our Simply Regenerative Organic Certified Quinoa line and our olive oil lines in Whole Foods and independent stores as well. And we're about 500 stores today.
Nice. Love Incredible. It. Love it. So we got a lot of things to talk about. We got to talk about vertically integrated international supply chains. We got to talk about startup CPG, you know, lifestyle and what that entails. We got to talk about how we do the certain products that y'all do regenerative, because we haven't really talked about those products before. But, you know, we know starting this business with all those different variables has been probably a crazy story. So just take us through the origin story and how this whole thing got started.
Yeah, absolutely. So for Simply, we started right before the pandemic. So in January 2020. So when we really set out and started Simply, we were actually focused on food service. So CPG.
I can't think of the worst time to start a food service focused business than January 2020. So congrats for being here. You know, that's incredible.
Yeah. In hindsight, absolutely. I think if we take a flashback to January 2020, I think everything was bright. The market's doing well. Obviously, people are out and about going to their favorite restaurants and quick service, what have you. So we were really excited. But really for us, when we sought after was a few things. It was to create a company that could actually have an impact in a meaningful and tangible way. But Sorella and myself, we love to travel. We love to immerse ourselves in different cultures, to meet new people of all walks of the earth, and really just to dive right in and try new foods all over the world. So, and we saw a white space of really looking at the transparency of international supply chains, understanding where the food comes from, who grew it. And we couldn't really find a company that did that for pantry items. So we really set out to create Simply to be that trusted ingredients brand. So when you're in your pantry at home, or when you're going to your favorite restaurant and eating different ingredients, that we would create Simply to be that trusted partner. So for us, it was really focusing on traveling, the impact that we make. And I think we've been able to really check all the boxes really well. And we've been fortunate to really grow from the pandemic. So, yeah, we started out in food service. 3 months later, every single restaurant shut down. So we really, again, it's just we had to have that entrepreneur mindset and to pivot quickly. So retail was doing really well. And also prepared meals was doing really well. So we got into both of those channels.
Hold on, can you walk us through, what does that look like? If, as a food service focused company who suddenly has to like, okay, we need to pivot quickly. You know, what did that actually look like in terms of what did you have to do? How did you have to, you know, from a food service perspective, did you even have branded products with labels, or was that something you had to start from zero when you switched to retail? What did that look like?
And why did you start in food service? Because I feel like that's very non-traditional. Yep. So I want to know that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. When we started, so my background comes in food service. I have been in the food and supply chain industry for about 12 years myself. Nice. Most recently, I was the head of food and beverage at Cava, which is a fast casual Mediterranean.
I love Cava, just for the record.
Huge. Very good. Thank you. Thank you. And Matt and I we've been together for 8 years now. So we've always wanted to create this concept and something to connect all the things that Matt mentioned to a product. And how do you bring the farming story and the traceability and the visibility and the impact socially and environmentally? So we decided to launch Simply. That was around October 2019. So we had a few months to put this together. We had our first container of quinoa come in around February. So we had three national food service accounts signed with us, and we were ready, set up in distribution. We were working with Be Good up in Boston, in Pizza in DC, and Little B up in New York. So amazing, amazing stores, over 100 stores right off the bat. And we were so excited. And March 2020 hit, and we were stuck with 44,000 pounds of quinoa and nowhere to go. And it was just Monday night, right? And it was,
that's a lot to take home and eat, you know?
Yeah.
That's a lot. Just because it grows when you cook it, man. That's a lot of quinoa.
More, it doubles when you cook it. But, we were in our home, which we both live in Washington, D.C., in a small condo, about 650 square feet. So obviously when the pandemic happened, you're locked down. So not only are we trying to grow a business, working with each other 24/7, living with each other, and doing all that in 650 square foot.
Bless you.
The visual I'm getting is you guys in the 650 square foot apartment, like swimming in quinoa, literally. I'm sure that wasn't the case. The quinoa was probably somewhere else, but that's what I keep thinking about. But sorry to interrupt, keep going.
Yeah. And until today, if you get a ride in our car, you will find quinoa in the trunk, in between the seats. It was any friend and family that has come to their house and visited, they leave with a few grains of quinoa in their bag because it was everywhere.
It was everywhere. It was incredible. But for us, I mean, we had a brainstorm right off the bat of how do we move 44,000 pounds of quinoa into not only develop a packaging that works for CPG, but also do that overnight. So for us as a company, again, really staying true to focus on sustainability, we wanted to create packaging that was also sustainable, that would look well on the shelves or online, since really it was only online that we were going to open up with. And that's how we kind of came up with a craft bag, because actually, from a bulk perspective for quinoa, when you bring it into the U.S., it's really 25-pound craft bags or 50-pound craft bags. So we really just took that idea and just minimize it to a CPG level. And
when you say craft bag, like what material is that made out of?
Yeah, our first iteration was literally like the lunch bag you take with you when you go to middle school or elementary school. Like wow. Literally that type of material, which we learned doesn't hold well when you're going through a distributor to go to the shelves. Mm-hmm. I mean, the number of times we saw our quinoa on the shelf that we would have to clean up when we got into brick and mortar was more times than I can count on my hands. But so that's been an entire learning experience. I mean, the packaging we have today is much more doable and durable in brick and mortars. But so we started out with that. We were even very thoughtful about resealing craft bags because obviously it's a little bit more difficult to do. We had a specific like a pin or what would you call it? It was like a pin that we put on every single bag, which obviously from a labor perspective is super intensive. And we created a few dozen of those bags. And I think our first brick and mortar was it was a local boutique. And then from there, mm-hmm. we kind of just scaled tremendously.
Yeah. And definitely we had to take that product and repackage it. So we had to find mm-hmm. retail was definitely a channel for it. But then we also had bulk partners, right? Milk, as Matt mentioned, meal kits and manufacturing was the second area where we wanted to focus on and just really start to building all their supply chains, which it was part of our strategy, but it wasn't the year of launch, right? We right. had that for year 3 or 4. But looking back, that's what Simply has been able to grow and be successful because we are diversifying all these different revenue streams and in different areas and different audiences where our customers can really connect in food service, on meal kits, mm-hmm. but also on retail. And it wasn't only the 44,000 pounds, but it was also the supply chain that we've been able to build. So at that time, it was whatever was in the water, so a few other containers, and then the commitment that we made back to our communities to build the vertical supply chains that we wanted to have for Simply and the transparency that we were built upon. So it was a whole supply chain of not finding a market for it was just not an option for us. It was which market can we find and how do we repackage it? And for retail, we a couple blocks from our house where it was a shared kitchen space called Mess Hall in DC, and we were able to get a membership working with Al, who runs the program there, and it's great. But we were also really tight on the budget because we had everything on inventory and building these supply chains and paying up front. And our business is super capital intensive. So we got a membership that it was from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m.
The graveyard shift.
Wow.
And Matt and I will have our day job and then we'll have our night job. And we will transport from our sublease warehouse, one pallet at a time. And we would take that pallet down, put it in our car, and bring it to Mess Hall to repackage it into the packaging.
Hold on, just for the visual, what kind of car are you driving where you can throw a pallet of quinoa inside the vehicle?
Yeah, it's a small SUV, but we looked at the weight. I think the most weight you want to have is 560 pounds of additional weight outside five individuals. And at any given time, we're about 2,000 or 3,000 pounds. So if you saw our car today, it's definitely lowered to the ground. The suspensions on it are definitely wiped out.
Right. Yeah. And that's why quinoa was everywhere, right? There's always, there's going to be a little trace in that car. But, you know, looking back, that has really, for us, for Matt as leaders now of this organization, and now we have a team of 20 amazing employees that, you know, we couldn't do what we do now without them. We have a great warehouse of 30,000 square feet and outside of Baltimore. We are distributed nationally for retail and food service or thousands of restaurants. And as I mentioned, 500 retail spaces. And we couldn't done that without the team that we have in place and the resilience that those early months really brought for Matt and I.
Yeah, it's just being scrappy early on. And I mean, even today, we continue to be scrappy as much as possible. But it's definitely a different mindset when you have an entire team. We couldn't do what we were doing today without our broader team.
Yeah, I know all about massive inventory risk, repacking product and being scrappy because the family business is a family fresh produce business. So I feel you there. I've been there. Let's shift gears into that supply chain, right? So let's talk regen practices. Let's talk actual products. Let's talk why Peru? Why Greece? You know, why these items? So just hit you with a bunch of questions, but maybe we'll start with the quinoa first. Why the region? What makes it regenerative? Just give us a little glimpse into Praxis, but also the supply chain.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it brings back to our origin when we got started. So the idea of Simply was bringing transparency onto these complicated, lots of middle party supply chains that you see on a global scale. I think that domestically, we do a really good job of telling the story of where our food comes from, with supporting your local farmer and your local ecosystem. But how do you do that in a global economy where the majority of food is being imported? Yeah. And that idea of bringing vertical supply chains and transparency into the market was what it was kind of built upon. As we started to expand into products, I'm Peruvian myself. Matt and I have been to Peru over 10 times together. And quinoa is one of those crops that it has been westernized. It has been in the market. Consumers know what it is. But the supply chain and the origin of it are not getting the benefits of that. And we've seen that firsthand, you know, when we were, you know, we've been hiking in Machu Picchu, but also in the Andes, 15,000 square feet up, with 15,000 feet up on the mountains. And it's small farmers, indigenous, exactly what you think, what, you know, people use and put pictures on their packaging. It's that, but they're not the ones benefiting from this amazing market that Europe and the US has been able to create, and customers are adjusting to it. And why is that? So we started to dive in, and it's because of all the middlemen and the parties in between that are taking advantage and really managing that demand. It's when we got started, I remember pitching quinoa, and people would say to me, you know, this is a crazy crop. Prices are going up and down. How are you going to manage your COGS? When I went to the farmers, the buying price from them has been stable, you know, maybe a 5-10% delta, but not what the selling price has seen. And it's because the middleman parties had managed that price so much to create that high demand into that market. So there was so much noise, and we just wanted to cut all that and bring a product that the consumer was familiar with it, but let's tell that transparency and the agricultural practices that are growing upon. Regenerative organic for us came really all about by learning the indigenous practices that are communities were doing, that are smallholder farming communities were doing for thousands of years, the respect they have for the land, for Pachamama in Peru specifically. And
Pachamama, is that a region, or is that like a type of like an indigenous practice?
It's kind of the mindset of just Pachamama means soil on the native language. And it's all about just you live by the land, you respect the land gives you, you should give. When we go out to the farms and, you know, we're eating and drinking with them, like you cheers your beer, but the first pour is to the land and then to you.
That's
so
awesome.
Which, by the way, you're only using one cup. These communities that we visit, it's one cup and many beers, but we all share one cup. And that's like the connectivity in addition to the food and sitting across from one another, eating amazing meals that these communities cook.
Yeah. And that whole concept of indigenous practices and respect the soil and being able to create an ecosystem was true to what we were trying to build. And that year in 2020, the movement of regenerative organic and the pilots that ROA was doing with Dr. Bronner's and Patagonia Provisions were coming to light, and the alignment on what that is built upon is very similar to what our indigenous communities are doing. And it creates a certification and a way to educate the consumer on all these amazing things that communities are doing, they've been doing for thousands of years, or farmers that want to transition back to a regeneration state. So we wanted to be part of it, and we wanted to be a brand that advocated and stood for that as well.
Yeah. And just to add to that, I mean, two of our pillars, like I mentioned from the beginning, is the environmental impact and the social impact. And that's extremely aligned with ROA, with Regenerative Organic Alliance, and what Regenerative Organic Certification is about. It's not only the focus of the health of the soil, but it's also make sure that you're fair trade or fair for life. So again, from our core, we've just been extremely aligned from the get-go. And that's why we've really been focused on, been very committed to growing our rock focus.
Then in quinoa, what are the actual practices that are most important to make it regenerative? Like I could tell you what it is for beef or for pasture poultry. Is it cover cropping? Is it animal integration? Is it crop rotation? You know, in that region and in that crop, like what really makes the difference?
Yeah, it's a combination of all of them. It's minimum tillage. It's a rotational crop is a big one. If quinoa rotates with lupini beans, which is a, if you're familiar with it, it's super high in protein. And we're just so excited to continue to advocate for it and bring it to market because we have a lot of lupini beans now to sell and find a home for it. So because it rotates with our quinoa, and that was one of the first items that we launched. It also rotates with potatoes or oats. It depends where quinoa grows. There's two main areas in South America. One is the high altitude, which is about 14,000 to 15,000 up. That's going to be a little bit drier. It only depends on natural irrigation. So just the rainy season, and there's one crop per year. Also maintaining the biodiversity of the area is really important. And that crop is going to be a little bit more resilient to pests just because it is so high up. So that you really don't experience much pest. The pest on the quinoa is mainly birds because of the sweetness that could grow on the grain. But there's a second region, which is a little bit on the lower side. So maybe like 10,000, 13,000 feet up. And that's the beautiful valley of the Andes in Peru where a lot of diverse foods grow. And that's where quinoa rotates more with chia seeds. Amaranth also grows in that area. Lupini beans also grows in those areas. So there's a little bit more of other crops that are welcoming to the quinoa. And for us also regeneration, because this is a crop that is natural to that area, to the Altiplano of Peru, we focus on the leadership development of the community. And I think that has been the big piece that has stopped for farming, small farmer holders to benefit from the export market, which it has been the leadership development side, the education. How do they, they might be already doing this work, but how do they segregate maybe some conventional tooling from some organic tooling? How do they keep track of the farmers, their yields, their storage, their invoicing for companies like Simply? So all the leadership that comes with the development of a co-op is what hasn't been done in this area. And that's where we come in to really support.
Love that.
That's incredible. And, you know, one of the coolest things about doing this podcast with Anthony is picking up on these recurring themes that happen throughout various different brands. And there's three I want to hone in on that you two have just sort of, you know, revealed to us. And it's the decommoditization of whatever the food is, which, like you said, takes the middleman out, allows you to, develop a direct trade relationship with the communities who are actually producing the food. And I had a third one. I just completely forgot what it was. but point two, I'm curious, like, what are some of those leadership? Oh, sorry. I remember point three was looking to the land to see what other types of product innovation you can bring to market that come from those same relationships that you have. But I'm really interested in what sort of leadership development projects you put together in some of these communities where you've developed these relationships.
Yeah, we can talk about Mario.
We have multiple examples of developing the leadership or even creating leadership within communities that don't even have an existing cooperative. The reason that we refer to cooperatives is because we work with farmers that have typically 1 to 2 acres, maybe 3 acres of land. So from a feasibility standpoint, we can't certify every single farmer. So what we do is we'll work with cooperatives or we'll establish cooperatives for some of these indigenous communities. So collectively, they're all certified together under one cooperative. But using Mario's example, it's been incredible what we've been able to achieve with him and obviously with his commitment of Simply and vice versa. He was just a conventional farmer and we went to visit him. I think the first time I met him, I think Sorrell met him before me, but the first time I met him was through during the pandemic. So in Peru specifically, the pandemic definitely was prolonged even further than I would say U.S. and some other developed countries around the world, just given their infrastructure and what have you. So they're still very, very tight on protocol, on traveling, even up to, I would say, the end of 2021. And for us being an essential business, because we are dealing with food, we had the opportunity to actually go visit these communities and continue operations throughout the pandemic. So when we went to visit Mario, he is just an extremely bright, so much positive energy comes out of him. And that really spreads to whoever he speaks with. But I think that the broader community definitely looks up to him, to his expertise, to his knowledge, and what have you. And we sat down with Mario and we looked at what he wanted to do in terms of goals for his broader community, in terms of the farming community, and where he was today and where he wants to be. And based off of that conversation with him, we developed a plan to work with him. And we really work with all of our farming communities. We don't dictate anything. We established what those goals are. And for Mario, we established what those goals were. We established a plan to get from where he is today to eventually become USDA organic certified, which we were able to achieve, and then also work towards regenerative organic certification, which we have achieved with him as well this year. And to go through that entire journey, and I think we mentioned journey a lot throughout the regeneration process, it is a journey. And we work with farmers who are conventional. We work with farmers who are transitioning to organic. We work with farmers who are organic. Our ultimate goal is to have all of our ingredients, our entire portfolio, rock certified. But we also understand there's clients out there, there's consumers out there who want to just have USDA organic certified or have transitional product as well. So we really serve our consumers and our clients on a mass scale, but still focus and hone in on working towards regenerative practices. And we've been able to do that really well with Mario and the broader community.
Yeah, and to add to the leadership piece, I think that is probably one of the most important things to develop vertical supply chains and also to develop the programs that Matt spoke of, transition and certification. And the reason why we're so aligned to certification is because it provides a premium to our communities, right? Like we can be amazing storytellers and we can be amazing at sharing what they do. But if we're not able to prove the work that they're doing with a third party audit, then it is going to be a tougher sell for the customer to be able to align to that. Yeah. So, and we also, it holds ourselves accountable as well, right? Mm-hmm. It holds ourselves accountable and it holds our communities accountable where there's so much fraudulent activity happening at the crop level. And we see that all the time. And, you know, we get offered product that is grown conventional with a black market organic certificate for paperwork to be imported. So it just holds all different parties accountable. But leadership, just to add one more thing, leadership is really important because they're the ones that are going to be running this program. It's not Matt and I, it's not our agronomist. It's not simply staff, you know, we're here to facilitate, but not to run the programs.
Yeah. And just to add real quick, I mean, in terms of being able to charge a premium for rock certified products, I mean, it comes back to it's accountability, but it's also validation. And that's really what ROA is there to really validate the work that we're doing from a third party perspective, from an unbiased perspective, which then consumers can also trust through that certification and through that stamp on our products that not only we're doing things right, but we're getting validated by a third party. We're being held accountable. And in return, we're holding our communities accountable too, to make sure that they're doing the right farming practices, that they're making sure that the money is actually going back towards the community and they're not holding it for themselves. Cause you do see that in the marketplace. And so I think it's accountability and validation among the entire supply chain.
Totally makes sense. It's a really great way to have to run and build a business. I want to shift gears a little bit here and talk about, you know, I mean, we really appreciate you sharing kind of the origin story and how you ended up in the position that you're in, why you're selling what you're selling. Let's talk about some like traction. You know, you mentioned that you've got Whole Foods. Is that Whole Foods global or is that Whole Foods in the DC region or where are you at specifically?
Yeah, with Whole Foods, we're in multiple regions. So we're on both coasts. And we're really excited to have an opportunity to grow with Whole Foods, given our alignment through regenerative organic agriculture that they obviously are very committed to this program, like ourselves. So, and it's also the type of consumers, the conscious consumers that are shopping at Whole Foods, also the chefs that work at restaurants and quick service, they're shopping at Whole Foods and these natural channels. So there's a lot of overlap and alignment for our customers and also for our core values and mission as a company.
And how are you guys positioned within the category? Because you're rock certified, to my knowledge, that's the first rock certified quinoa in the aisle. Is that correct, or are there others?
Yeah, we were first to market for Regenerative Organic Certified Quinoa. And we're also first to market for a number of ingredients that we source out of our out of the countries in South America. And for us as a company, we're really excited about not only the traction we've had to date, but what's in our pipeline. So one of the things that we've been focused on is really expanding the offerings for pantry items. We're really focused on innovation in the middle of the aisle, which there hasn't been a lot or much of in the past decade. So if you think about, again, grains, beans, even some superfoods and oils, those are the four categories we're focused on. In terms of what we're launching early next year, it's going to be five new bean types, which I think we will be first to market for being Regenerative Organic Certified. We have an additional grain that we're going to be launching. And then also in the superfoods category, chia seeds will be another item. So, but for us, it's really focused on the pantry items. And in terms of innovation, we think about innovation in two ways. One, how we can be more value add, and really the Regenerative Organic certification is value add. It's a better product. Obviously, it combats against climate change, so it has the environmental stamp pack, and then it's also with the social impact. But also, the second piece of innovation is how can we create packaging to be more sustainable? Obviously, when you go through the middle of the aisle, you see a lot of plastic. So how can we move away from plastic into more sustainable packaging? And that's something that we're really focused on and really lives throughout our company.
I want to draw attention to one thing that I think is really different about y'all than most of the people that we talk to, or most of the regen brands in the space. Is what I'm hearing is you sell ingredients, you have the ingredients channel, you have the food service channel, you have the retail channel. Like, we've mentioned lupini beans in this conversation, but when I go to your website, I don't see anything about lupini beans because you're not selling them at retail. And I think the average consumer doesn't have a lot of education there. You know, I have a little bit of background in both food service and retail distribution, but people fail to realize, like, sometimes the quinoa that you get at the store is really way different than the quinoa that you eat at a restaurant. And I'm not saying that's the case for you all, but educate just the average consumer on why that's important from a regenerative standpoint and the biodiversity and the crop rotation, but also how it affects your business and how shipping, I don't know what lupini bean would be, but a 30-pound bulk lupini bean food service versus a 5-pound retail versus quinoa, you know, because you're dealing with more commodities than just what people would see on your website.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Anthony. I think that Matt talked a little bit about this, about the journey. It's about the journey of regeneration. And in order for us to make that work and to support the 97% of conventional agriculture that leads the industry today in transition that to where we want to, what the goal is within Simply, which is to have diverse ecosystems, we have to create a market for all the different crops that are the rotational crops, but also they're in different stages doing that transition. If it's conventional, transitional, organic, or regenerative, if it's a quinoa that will rotate with that lupini bean, or the chia that rotates with amaranth, or maca that also rotates with oats, right? And we started in Peru. I'm Peruvian, so I am biased, but it is a super diverse country of all of the things that has to offer. But we've been able to expand. Paraguay has an amazing chia seed program that rotates with sesame seeds. And we are creating market for those two items. And that also rotates with red kidney beans as well. In Argentina, sunflower oil. In Brazil, we're working with protected indigenous communities for acai that are going to be wild harvest. Wow. Greece was the second country we launched with, because Greece agriculture is very similar to South America. There are smallholder farmers that hold small amounts of land, and the single origin authenticity of its food, it's incredible at a nutritional level point as well. We bring Kalamata olives that are from Kalamata. We're bringing extra virgin olive oil from the Sparta Peloponnese region. And then in the northern region, we're working on the first regenerative organic bean program in Greece for Gigante beans that rotate with lentils and rotate with chickpeas. And then Ukraine. Ukraine was the third country, I think, that we started working out of for sunflower oil. So we have been there through the war wow. that happened. Yeah. So we, yeah. you know, our, what our communities are going through, we were building a regenerative organic sunflower oil program out there, which obviously had to be paused with everything that happened. So we transitioned to Argentina to have dual supply chain. But because we're so deep embedded into these communities, into the work that we're doing, we have to create a market that is diverse enough, just like our supply chains are. And that's where diversification of being a ingredient supplier for CPG brands or manufacturers is important for us, but also having a channel food service where we can work with high volume and have the economies of scale that we need to have right off the bat for these supply chains is important. And then retail is really important because we have to educate the consumer on what is regeneration. And it starts with the consumer to make those decisions. So when they go to their favorite restaurant a couple miles down the road from Whole Foods, they can see simply, or they can learn about regenerative organic and what it stands for.
Yeah, I think, education is absolutely key for learning more about regenerative organic agriculture. And I think we are, given what's going on around the world today, in terms of just natural disasters, it's not isolated to regions. Natural disasters are happening worldwide, whether it's forest fires, droughts, significant changes to temperatures, whether it's water or air. I mean, and that's one of the first things that every single farmer we visit, which again, this is all throughout South America and also Europe. So it's not just isolated in a specific region. Yeah. One of the first things that comes up in conversation is the impact that their farms are having directly contributed by climate change. They're seeing drastic changes. And we're talking about just a number of years. I mean, sometimes even 1 or 2 years, but drastic changes over 3 to 5 years of what it was to today and how that's affecting their yield and how that's affecting their crops, how it's affecting the delay of their crops, which all has an impact on their livelihoods. But getting back to education, I think, again, and while we're really excited to work with Whole Foods, and there's other platforms out there as well. I mean, Thrive is another great platform from an e-commerce yeah. perspective. But working with aligned-minded companies and that have really impactful and powerful platforms, such as like Whole Foods and Thrive have, it really will accelerate the education of conscious buyers to understand why they should purchase regenerative organic certified products versus conventional products. And really, they're able to put their money towards brands that are making an impact. And I think also, I mean, we're just one brand out there. There's a lot of great brands out there that are doing a lot of wonderful things. And we as brands have to work together as well. We're going to be much more powerful to work collectively versus individually. I know there's been a number of awesome brands that have been on this podcast so far, and that's just awesome to see. But for us to work together, we're going to make a lot more progress sooner by working together versus individually.
You're really speaking my language. As someone who like works in retail, I've built a thing called the Regen Coalition, which is bringing regenerative brands together to create educational opportunities and promotional opportunities for retailers to be able to figure out how to support regen, because it's really hard. But I want to talk about what's not in my wheelhouse right now. And I'm so interested in, as somebody who grew up working in restaurants as a waiter at, you know, at small independent locations and like giant corporations like P.F. Chang's, you know, I worked at P.F. Chang's for like 4 years. How do you tell a regenerative story when you're providing ingredients to those restaurants? Like, is it like menu call outs? Is it educating the staff? Like, what does that look like?
Great question.
Yeah, that is a good question, Kyle. And for us, we start with the leadership at the restaurant group. So we work with, as I mentioned, Jazz Salad or Chopped or Sweetgreen, Dig In, and is having that alignment right off the bat for their customers, and is working with their team on how can we take that education piece and in which platform can live. So with Jazz Salad, we were able to do lots of different activations. I mean, it's a brand that in its core and its DNA is built on sustainability. So understanding the movement of healthy soils, sequester carbon, reverse climate change, I think it is digestible for their customers and for their staff internally. With Chopped, it was about really telling the story of why is a Kalamata olive from Kalamata different in the authenticity of its single origin versus other different olives that are in the market. It's a natural preserved and fermented oil, which I believe is the only is one out of two types of olives in the market that doesn't add any color additives or any chemicals for the preservation piece of it. It's natural with vinegar in the rotation of 6 months. But it could be activated through digital media, social platforms, of course, is powerful, newsletters. We do also brick and mortar activations. So menus on their menu boards, on the physical menu as well, whereas Simply Rock ingredient or Simply ingredient. We also do a lot of education with just like handouts, papers. We've also looked into having a, we have an olive oil program with a pizza group on the olive oil, you know, squeezy bottle for the olive oil and telling the information. So it's, you got to get creative. And it's also what the brand allows us to do or they want to communicate to their customers.
And it's really for us as a company, because we have these fully vertical supply chains, what really makes us stand out versus some brands out there is the storytelling. It's the storytelling of the entire journey. I know we say journey in many different aspects, but for the journey of the food, from go to these farms, we capture the story of the family that are actually growing these ingredients. We capture the story of how the ingredient itself is grown. We capture from taking that ingredient, say from the middle of South America and Paraguay, and bring that all the way up to Baltimore, Maryland, or to California. And then from there, it'll get shot out to hundreds or thousands of restaurants across the U.S., telling that entire story. Because I think that's what really resonates with consumers, is seeing all the work that goes into bringing these great quality ingredients to their plate. I think it's something really special. And so it makes it easier to tell the story when you have content like that. Also, when we're working with like-minded brands, they see the value of Simply. They see the value of the work we're doing, and we're empowering them through the demand that they create to really make a change for the better through food for the world. I think, I think the big opportunity here that needs to be mentioned is also to get the conglomerates out there, to get those large corporations that really are less focused on the impact, focused more on bottom line and cost. Those are the ones that are going to really move the needle, really move the rock in a positive way. We have to get them on board to really focus on regenerative organic certified products in order to really have meaningful impact in a more shorter timeline.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. And two kind of comments and a question. One is, I think you guys have killed the branding. I'm a pretty big brand snob, but the brand's phenomenal. Two, I think it's a really unique kind of vantage point to think about trade spend or trade marketing from not just a traditional retail brick and mortar end cap ad spend, you know, component that you guys are obviously activating in those other channels. And then three, you know, I'm an investor in the space. And so when I hear aligned partnerships, one of those other themes that we've heard in almost every conversation that Kyle talked about is we need regenerative capital, just like we need, you know, regenerative this or regenerative that. So super curious. You guys have been all over the place. You've gone through the pandemic. We're talking different channels. We're talking all these different ingredients. How have you funded this whole thing, and how has that all played out?
Yeah, so we've been able to grow as quickly as possible just by finding impactful investors. And for us as a company, we have done a small equity raise, but we really focus on increasing our debt capacity, because for us as a company, our business model is inherently capital intensive. One of the things that we do is we'll pay, especially with all the indigenous communities we work with and the protected indigenous communities we work with, one of the benefits and really value add is to pay our farmers up front. So not to have payment terms with our farmers, because they don't live off of much at all. I mean, it's incredible just how they are to live based on their income. But one of the ways that we can really have an impact on a farmer level and also build trust. I think that's a key point here, is we have to build trust, which takes time to build trust with these communities. But we'll pay our farmers up front. We'll even have programs where we'll finance the seeding for the harvest. So again, that's another way that really helps out the farming communities. So for me and for us at Simply, we really focus on finding debt capital, working capital that allows us to implement those type of programs. Right now we just work with regional banks and eventually we'll have the conversations for institutions, but I think also given the impact we have as an organization, another channel that is available for us is working with nonprofits and working with NGOs who provide loans that are connected with the impact. And so that's something that we're readily having active conversations with as well in tandem with just working with our regional bank and what have you.
And I want to touch on that debt piece, Matt, because I don't think a lot of people understand what that is the opposite of. So status quo, right, in the CPG universe is a farmer gets paid by a middleman ingredient supplier, and they might pay them on 30, 60, 90 day terms. Then that person would supply that ingredient to a co-man on 30, 60, 90 day terms. Then the brand would order from the co-man and they would pay them on 30, 60, 90 day terms. And the whole thing's disjointed. It's all elongated. And there's all that time and money, and basically money lost and all that time. And what you're talking about is going directly to farmers, helping them pay to actually grow, right? The end product, and then paying them immediately on the offtake, right? So there's just so much money and time saved, and it's so radically different. And then you have to adjust the financials to accommodate that. But just kudos to you guys. And I wanted to, for the average person, just to kind of draw that out.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, everything you said does make it capital intensive, but I think the benefit too, though, is going quick to market. I mean, that's definitely a strength of ours, is the resiliency of our supply chains. We didn't have any disruptions throughout the pandemic, but also throughout the global supply chains, the issues that they, and the challenges that they've been having, especially in 2021, that was definitely a strength of ours, because we don't have any middle people, because we're paying our farmers up front. We're building that trust. We're able to get product out quickly from country of origin, into the US, and then distribute it out with our partners. So, there are benefits to working with that type of model too, but it absolutely benefits both us and the farmer.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I know we kind of touched on future outlook a little bit earlier. You mentioned innovation and a few other things, but I do want to get a little bit deeper into, you know, from a retail specific, like branded product specific, you know, viewpoint, you know, what does the future look like? You know, you mentioned some potential new products to market. Are there new retail partners that could be coming online soon? And no pressure. You don't have to reveal that if you don't want to. I realize it's kind of an invasive question as I ask it. But, you know, are there specific, you know, markets? You mentioned coast to coast distribution, or have you guys tackled, you know, center country yet? You know, what does all that look like?
Yeah, for us. So I think from the get go, we really focus on, we understood that in order to scale as a company and to have just a global scale, distribution is key. So for us, we really focus on having distribution both in food service and retail. Which we've been able to achieve. So on the food service side, we work with all the main broadliners, or the largest, the U.S. Food, Sysco, PFG, GFS. We also work with regional distributors too, that are just awesome distributors in the food service side. On the retail side, we do work with Unify, coast to coast. So we do have that distribution footprint. In terms of our growth and new retailers, we're just really excited about the product launches that we have. That are coming online in the next 6 months. The reason you can't see the Lupini beans yet online on our website is because it's still going through R&D, but we have finalized that. So we will be launching that in the coming months. Nice. So that
Lupini beans. Can you talk about what sort of format that's going to be in the beans? Is it going to be canned? Is it going to be perishable?
Like, what just like that. Yeah, it's going to be dried beans. Okay. So just like with our quinoa, which again is in sustainable packaging, we extended that packaging for all the products that we're launching, or for most of the products we're launching in 2023. But like I said, it's five bean types that are going to be dry beans. They're going to be coming from either Peru or Greece. We also have a new grain that's going to be coming from Peru, and then the chia seeds and the superfoods category. So those will all be launching in 2023 for the holidays. So talking a little bit sooner, in the next couple of weeks, we actually have a really exciting product for the holidays that we're launching, which is going to be salt. It comes from Maras, Peru, so in the Andes. Wow. So it comes from natural water springs high up in the Andes. We work with an amazing woman producer. Her name's Yolanda, who develops and harvests the salt. And we have two other salts that will be blended with some spices as well, just in time for the holidays.
Wow. D2C retail, where can people find that one?
Yeah, that's going to be D2C to start out with, but we're actively talking for brick and mortar as well for retail. So cool. Hopefully you'll be able to find that in your local grocery store in the next couple of months.
Very cool. Okay. So that's the Simply Future. Let's go macro. And we always kind of tee this conversation up with the question that we ask everybody. And really what the question means is, how do we scale regen, right? But the specific question is, how do we get regen brands to 50% market share by 2050?
That's a heavy question.
I left you a lot of time, Cirilla, so you take as much time as you need, okay?
No, I appreciate framing it that way, because we certainly have to make that change with a timeline in mind, in order to see what we're experiencing, right? Like, I mean, climate change is here. And if you haven't experienced it, I don't know where you're living under a rock, but it's tangible to everyone and everywhere in the world that we've traveled and we've been able to visit. So we have to make that change. Either we have to celebrate and maintain the amazing work that our indigenous communities are doing, so they don't have an incentive to not continue to do that. But most importantly, I think we need to reverse the monocropping and the industrial agriculture that we see in order to bring back those practices. So I think to get there, from a macro perspective, the way that United States, which is one of the biggest markets in the world, North America, for consumerism, the way the food supply chain is set up has to radically change. The way that we think of purchasing has to radically change. And this goes from CPG companies, from the co-manufacturings, but also most important, the retailers, where I mean, I get why monocropping leads and works, right? It's effective. You plan ahead, you have your volumes, you can control. I'm an engineer myself. So I you work from the productivity level and understanding what the yields are going to be and what can you control the most in order for that demand that is not changing. When COVID hit, that's when outages and supply chain disruptions happened because demand completely changed of how consumers consume food. So these long, massive global supply chains could not adapt quick enough because they were not fast enough to do so. So that vertical integration has to be a way where big brands, big ag, has to follow in the way that our internal domestic North America supply chain for distribution and buying and education to consumers has to radically change, where we should not expect strawberries to be around all year round here in Baltimore, Maryland, in any supermarket that I go to. So consumer habits have to change, and we have to make radical change in our supply chains.
Go ahead, Kyle.
I was just going to say, I think it's really interesting the way you framed up like the control aspect of conventional farming. And I completely agree that that's like, that's what they're trying to do, but it assumes that the environment within that control doesn't change, right?
Correct.
But when you start to realize that controlling that environment has drastic impacts on everything else, and when, to your point, when there's disruption in the environment, everything goes to hell in a handbasket. You know, what we're seeing now with the war in Ukraine and all sorts of other reasons, like synthetic inputs have gone through the roof, those prices. So whatever you think you might be controlling, like these are our costs, whatever, it's actually not really in your control. And there's some detrimental effects by assuming that we can control all these things. Whereas the regenerative production method is significantly more resilient because it doesn't rely on all of those externalities. So I just think it's a really interesting way you frame that up. And that's the thought process that led me down. But Matt, go ahead. There's something else you were going
to
comment on.
Yeah, no, I think the only thing to add is, I mean, a great way, because we can't have radical change overnight. Obviously, consumers, they like what they do, and change is not comfortable for consumers. So I think in terms of really make a change for the long term, it really starts not only with the consumer to be more curious, to understand the benefits of moving away to more seasonality. But I think in terms of restaurants and just stores out there, the move to like seasonality, right? Seasonality menus, seasonal menus, et cetera. I think that are baby steps in order to really change the patterns of how consumers eat today. And I think that will allow us to really make changes in terms of our buying patterns, in terms of our eating patterns, to move away from monocropping. But I think, I mean, it's that, and just education is going to be key in terms of how we can actually make a meaningful impact in the next 5 years through regenerative agriculture. And I think a lot of people are starting to understand just the amount of benefits it is to purchase regenerative organic certified products, but we're just getting started. I think it's also with third parties with the bills are getting passed through our government, not only in the U.S., but also abroad in Europe and elsewhere. I think we collectively, not only brands, but consumers and government entities and NGOs, we all got to work together in order to really move the rock and in order to really make progress in the next couple of years.
Yeah, couldn't agree more with all those points. The seasonality thing is always so tricky to me because I come from that produce world. And, you know, my grandpa started selling produce in the early 1900s. And so there was only strawberries in America when they were grown in California, and they were in season in California and Florida. And that was it. You didn't see them in the store other than that. And now we do have them all year round. We have grapes all year round because we have a global economy. And I think that that ship has sailed. Like, I don't know if consumers are ever going to be willing to go back to not having that selection. So I think the question for me is then how does it go from we sell 3 pallets of strawberries at that store a week to we sell one, and we're replacing that with something else that's like more seasonal. And I have yet to figure out like what the answer to that is, but I do think it starts on the food service side, because that is they're the curators and they're the tastemakers of diets. And then those purchases are followed up at retail. So Sorella, I'm just curious on what your take, like what are the levers we can pull to like increase that seasonality?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's a complex problem, right? Because when there is demand, growing countries will follow. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing that right now. I mean, we've seen it with avocados, right? Mm-hmm. Huge demand of avocados in the market. So farmers stopped growing what it was native to them, potatoes, and switched that crop to avocado growing. Now there's this massive surplus of avocado, or there was last year, of avocados, and then prices dropped. So now there is all this avocado in the market, and farmers don't want to grow it next year. So the demand and supply is what really drives what farmers grow. I have a really interesting story about Sacha Inchi. I don't know if you're familiar with what that is, but it's a superfood out of the Amazon side of South America. And Korea was a big buyer of Sacha Inchi for years because it was trendy. It was an item that they put a great marketing commercial out there, and the market really welcomed Sacha Inchi in the superfood powder. But as a trend, trends die. So farmers would, you know, they were so excited about this crop because it was a high paying crop for them. Because in their mind, there was a demand, but it was a trend demand. So Korea stopped importing Sacha Inchi, and now the Amazon has a bunch of Sacha Inchi in the market. That it is a crop. It is a wild, it could be a wild crop, but it could also be a harvest crop. And they put money into the processing, which is where the investment of the farming comes in for powderized product. And now they're sitting on powderized Sacha Inchi stock, and the price is just vomited. And that's their day to day. So trends and creating seasonality into menus is something that it has to be thoughtful into. What is there a supply of, and how can you educate consumers on that? For example, quinoa went in, you know, high demand, but lupini crops stopped to decrease because there was no market for it, because consumers were not aware of it. No one really educated for it. So it is our job now to educate. Why is lupini beans so great for you, for the farmer, for the environment? Super packed in protein. Why are the potatoes really good for environment? I think that we do, you know, we consume a lot of domestic potatoes, but if we wanted this global economy, as you mentioned, where you are expecting potatoes to be in your shelves all year round, we need to import potatoes from communities that are going to have that that crop available, because it is good for rotational of certain items. So it is starts, I think, the creation of menus and discovery places at the restaurant is and especially on the fine dining side, is where the trend starts. But how do we work with a community of chefs to educate them on the concept of rotational crops and availability of these crops to be introduced into the market?
Mm-hmm. And people have no idea how unseasonal the majority of our diets are. This is like produce business, love the produce business. Everyone works their butts off. They respond to market demands. Like the business that we have is because of the economy that we have. So no finger wagging, no finger pointing, but like apples, we grow one crop in Washington and we throw them in giant rooms with no oxygen, so they last for the whole year. Idaho potatoes, we do the same thing. Onions, we do the same thing. And it's like, guys, those onions were harvested like 9 months ago and they're still good. And they taste fine. And like, it's an amazing like testament to modern, like, you know, industry and whatever, but is it good, you know, or is something else good? Like, you know, no one really knows the exact answer to those questions, but we need to be talking about it.
Well, and I think it's like a macro cultural level. It's like the decommercialization of essentially everything that kind of needs to happen. And I really believe that trend is already beginning. You know, again, going back to my P.F. Chang's days, you know, the whole point of P.F. Chang's and Starbucks and Cheesecake Factory and these humongous multinational things is that everything tastes the same wherever you go, the exact same ingredients. Mm-hmm. And as the consumers continue to demand those types of products, like, it forces the producers to grow those types of products. Mm-hmm. But if we can get rid of that and focus more on supporting independent, local people who are sourcing those types of ingredients, it can help to build that sort of economy, because then the farmer has a choice. Instead of like, hey, the only people I can serve are the people who need this spec onion, you know, to your point, Anthony, that sits in this room for 9 months because that's what P.F. Chang's is going to buy in 10 years, whatever it is. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But if we can create those local regenerative economies, then I think it allows the production level to focus on like what their environment really allows them to grow, rather than trying to pigeonhole, you know, a square peg into a round hole because that's what they think the next hot trend is going to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think that gets back to collective action in terms of you have these multinational franchises and brands out there, restaurant brands out there. If they add one item to their menu that is more mm-hmm. seasonal, and again, we can't make the change overnight. Consumers are they're just not going to go along with that. But if we have these baby steps and over time evolve the menu from what it is today to what it can be, to really incorporate the future of how sourcing and how farming should be, then I think that's going to be a really meaningful step. And we have to get them on board because they're the ones that are serving millions of customers around at all times. So yeah, we definitely need to get them involved in this.
Mm-hmm. And,
well, a big part of the way brands, we get there is having the ability to support brands like you, you know? Mm-hmm. So exactly. I think it's a good place to call it an episode. Yeah, so really appreciate you guys diving into your whole story. I think what you're doing is awesome. I really love the food service and retail, like, simultaneous parallel approach. So yeah, thanks for sharing everything. And, you know, just quick last thing, where can people buy your product? Is it simply.com, eatsimply.com? Is that what it is?
Yeah. So simply ends with an I instead of a Y. And really the reason we came about that is because of impact, innovation, international, and ingredients. They all start with I, and that's really why we decided to go with I instead of Y. But yes, it's eatsimply.com. You can find our products online, and then also through different e-commerce platforms, your local Whole Foods and other natural retailers.
Love it. Thanks y'all so much. Congrats on everything.
Thank you both. Thank you for having us today and being a platform to educate about regenerative movement.
Absolutely.
Thank you, everyone.
For show notes and more information on our guests and what we discuss on the show, check out our website, regen-brands.com. That is regen-brands.com. You can also check out our YouTube channel, Regen Brands Podcast, for all of our episodes with both video and audio. The best way to support our work is to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform and subscribe to future episodes. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Regen Brands Podcast, brought to you by the Regen Coalition and Outlaw Ventures. We hope you learned something new in this episode, and it empowers you to use your voice, your time, and your dollars to help us build a better and more regenerative food system. Love you guys.